Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me this time, again, is Susanna McIntyre. Susanna, and she's the CEO of Atheist Republic, and she's here to, we're talking about abortion today, and we're talking about the differences between Islam's view and Christianity's view on abortion. And Susanna and I talked, and Susanna was actually really animated about this topic recently, and I thought it was an excellent topic to bring up. And I think, Susanna, you should start talking about why you specifically wanted to address this topic today.
Okay, so for those who are not aware, which may be difficult if you're in North America, you'd have to be living under a rock. Texas, there is a bill that was enacted into law in the beginning of September called SB 8, which is the most restrictive abortion bill or on the law on the books in the United States right now, that effectively bans abortion, but technically it criminalizes. Well, no, it doesn't criminalize. It's very sneaky, judicial, legislative, sneaky work, trickery to make it extremely dangerous and disincentivize women from getting abortions past 6 weeks or as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detected.
It does effectively outlaw it.
Effectively, yes.
It outlaws it, yeah.
Yeah. And when that was enacted into law and it came into effect, there was a lot of outrage in America, particularly, you know, on the liberal side, understandably so. Ali and I share that outrage. If you want to learn more about the specifics of this, I recommend you go listen to the episode we did like 2 weeks ago, where we interview Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, who's a constitutional lawyer, to talk about this. It's titled Roe v. Wade is Dead? ? If you want to go look that up. And I'm on the left, but sometimes the left makes me want to rip my own hair out. And I will present to you a prime example of this. So there were things trending like hashtag Texas Taliban or SB8 Sharia. And I think what encapsulates this is this cartoon I saw. So here in this cartoon, we see two women, presumably in Afghanistan. You know, it's kind of a mountainous background. They're in full black niqab, with only the eyes showing. And they're saying, pray for Texas women. Okay, guys. For those who aren't familiar with my background, I used to be like a super Wilkes Gold offense junkie. Okay. That part of me has been killed. So it is not very often when I say that something offends me. This offended me so much. This made me so mad. And major feminists like Amy Siskind, I think that's how you pronounce her name, tweeted this. And we're like, hashtag Texas Taliban. And Oh my God. Okay, so let me break down why this makes me so mad. It makes me so mad because this is the epitome of navel gazing. This is the epitome of like North American leftist navel gazing. And it makes me so angry that people think that the situations are comparable. Not only is this inaccurate for reasons that we are going to discuss today, But just because something is bad for women in Texas, that doesn't mean that we have to act like it's even remotely comparable to what women in Afghanistan are going to go through and continue to go through. You know? Oh my God. As someone who works every single day with women who have their lives destroyed, severely harmed, literally physically tortured by their families on the basis of their Islamic understanding or their attempts to coerce them into following their understanding of Islam more stringently, this made me so mad. Like, why in the world would a woman going through this in the Muslim majority world have any priority towards these women in Texas? Maybe they do. If so, that's like way more empathetic than I could even conceptualize of, because if it was me, I'd just be worried about my own self-preservation. So it was the pure navel-gazing narcissism of it that made me so furious. Ali, what do you think?
So, yeah, I agree with you, and I actually have a little bit of an analogy to help people understand, you know, what you're talking about, and you know, what I'm going to say here too. And so, just one thing to clarify, I mean, nobody's diminishing the horror of the Texas abortion law. That's not what we're diminishing. Mm-hmm. What the objection here is the fact that we're diminishing what the women in Afghanistan go through overall. Right. I mean, I understand, like, you know, Sam, I mean, this didn't outrage me as much as it did you, but I first of all, I don't have a uterus and I'm not a woman. That's one thing. The second thing is, I understand what the cartoonist is trying to say. They're talking specifically about the law. I mean, the cartoons are not necessarily literal, but there is this tendency for people to start comparing, and anything that goes regressive here, they start saying, well, look at this third world country. We're just as bad as this. The analogy I was going to give was that horrific sort of rape case that happened in India a few years ago, right?
One in the Delhi bus?
Right, in the Delhi bus, the woman who's like gangrene, and just, I can't even talk about it. It's just horrendous. So when that happened, there were a lot of articles you saw popping up in The Guardian and, you know, all these other places about how, you know, the rape rates, right, the incidence of rape, the prevalence of rape in Sweden, in other European countries, is higher than it is in India and Saudi Arabia. So people started talking about, they're like, well, you know, you're talking about this case in India. Well, look at how bad we have it here. Look at how bad the women have it here. And that is, it's not, you know, not to diminish that, of course, like rape and sexual assault is a massive, massive issue, even in North America, even developed countries, Western countries. But so it's not to diminish that. It's just this idea that when you compare those things, that absolutely outrages women in India, who are dealing at this on a level of sort of epic proportions. I mean, you have
the level of sexual violence that cannot be put into like words for the sake of this segment.
Yeah. I mean, you just can't do it. And all of these, yes. Okay. The prevalence of rape in Sweden. I mean, Sweden, the definition of rape is very different. The number of people who are able to report it without being stigmatized, right, is very, very different. I mean, that does not happen in India. There's so many different factors. Yeah.
I swear, like, people who try to bring up that argument, it's like they've never heard of the limitations section of an academic article.
Yeah.
It's so frustrating.
It's like, you know, every article, yeah, this research has the following limitations, as, you know, declarations of conflicts of interests. There's all these caveats. But, you know, when you're going for headlines and you have an activist agenda.
Or really bad apologism. Yeah. This is where we end up.
This is where you end up. And what people don't realize, you understand the point that they're trying to make, that, you know, we've got problems here at home that we need to address that are also really bad. You know, we're pretending like this is happening somewhere foreign, but there's a lot of terrible people here doing terrible things too. Yes, that's good. But it's that you can do that in a way that doesn't diminish or downplay the absolute incomparable, completely incomparable horror of things that happen in some of these other countries, like Afghanistan, like India, like Pakistan, like Saudi Arabia. I mean, those things, there's absolutely no way. I mean, the people who talk about, I mean, women's rights, you know, there's this whole thing that, well, women have it really bad here too. I mean, Saudi Arabian women sometimes have it better than us. There were these articles actually going around as well.
I actually might bring forth some of those arguments myself today to just to toss things up. So that'll be interesting. Well,
so that's the flip side. That's the fun part of this, that, you know, the flip side of
this is going to go in some unexpected directions.
Yeah. Now here's something that might surprise you, is that now on the other hand, you know, the other reason this thing is wrong, in a way, well, this thing may be slightly accurate for that reason, but the reason that, you know, when people say American Taliban, the reason that is objectively a false comparison is because there is a difference between the way that Islam views abortion and Christianity views abortion. And we're talking about across the different sects. And the difference is that Islam is actually much more liberal when it comes to abortion. It's much more permissive. It's much more pro-choice. And so that's kind of what we're going to get into.
Well, okay, that's starting to get a little strong language, okay? Some people try to make the argument that it is pro-choice. I'm not going to say that. But in comparison to Catholicism, it looks like that. Okay.
That's the point. We're talking on a relative scale.
Yeah.
So it's, by pro-choice, I mean the choice of the husband. But abortion, generally, right, in Islam, is... allowed, it's effectively an option for a lot of people who want to do it. You know, obviously there are caveats to that too. But let's start, Susanna, let's talk about the view of, you know, you grew up in a very sort of religious Catholic background, right?
Oh, yeah. So
what can you tell us? Like, just give us the overall view. What does the religion actually say about abortion? Why are Christians so...
Okay, well, I'm going to preface this. So I grew up Catholic, so I'm going to be talking about this from a Catholic perspective, okay? A contention I have whenever I'm in an ex-Muslim setting, there are often voyeuristic Christians who then come in and tell me that actually I never was a Christian because Catholics aren't Christians and Catholicism is actually following the Antichrist and all this stuff, okay? So first of all... just want to say, like, to you Protestants who think that way, when you say that, you actually make the cat, I'm an atheist, but you make the Catholic in me jump out. It makes me so upset. But so I'm just going to preface this with saying this is a Catholic understanding. There are differences within Protestantism of various branches, but this is what I know. This is what I know how to research, meaning I know how to look at the catechism of the Catholic Church to go find this understanding versus with Protestantism. It's way too diffuse for me to go find a central understanding in the same way that the catechism of the Catholic Church is way more centralized to me in my understanding. But, you know, that's my background. So I just want to give that preference. Basically... abortion is a big deal in Catholicism. It is one of only 9 offenses that will result in automatic excommunication. There are no circumstances, basically no circumstances in which it is okay. It can only be okay if it is if there is like serious medical harm to the mother, but even that is not necessarily always consistent. So one thing, as I was researching this, interestingly, this is from a quote from Yakin Institute, or so this is actually an Islamic source talking about this Ghazalism thing, but I think they put it very succinctly, so I'm going to read this quote. Yet centuries ago, even the Catholics had some room for debate on this topic, meaning when abortion is okay and when it isn't. Before 1869, the church held a similar position to Islamic jurists that tolerated abortions for various needs before the 40th day of pregnancy. It is also noteworthy that in complete contrast to the Islamic position of prioritizing the life of the mother in all cases, so the Islamic position is if there is a threat to the mother's health and safety, then it is permitted. The church preferred the life of the fetus than to that of the mother on the basis that the mother had already been baptized and is guaranteed salvation while the child had not yet been provided with such an opportunity. So there are understandings in which actually the life of the child is more important than that of the mother, and an abortion is not even permissible in those circumstances. So it is not permissible in the circumstance of sexual assault. It's not permissible in the circumstance of incest. Financial instability. You know, like that's not an excuse. There's basically no situations in which it's okay. I mean, the Catechism of the Catholic Church doesn't even permit abortion. Sorry, contraception. Contraception, right, under any circumstance. So there is only one setting in which intercourse is appropriate, and that is in the setting of holy matrimony. That's it. Holy matrimony with the express intention of creating life. You're not even really supposed to, you're not allowed to do it for sexual pleasure. Like, even Islam will talk about the sexual needs of the spouses, actually. And that's okay, and that's permissible. Like, that's not the case in Catholicism. So it's actually much more restrictive than Islam in this sense. And I can actually read parts of the catechism about abortion if we're interested in it. It's only like six small, like mini paragraphs or sentences. And that's like the entirety of the statement on the matter. But I thought it was very interesting that a lot of people don't know that there are only 9 offenses that can qualify you for automatic excommunication, meaning as soon as that thing is committed, you don't need someone else to proclaim you excommunicated. By the mere committing of that act, you are automatically excommunicated. And having an abortion or assisting in one is one of those 9 offenses.
Yeah, this is actually something, you know, because you talked about contraception. I mean, just backing with, I think it was Pope Benedict who went to Africa, and this was at a time when the HIV prevalence in Africa was just on average, like I think in South Africa, it was 1 in 4 people, like, you know, 25% of people were HIV positive. And he went there and talked against condom use. Okay. That is criminal. I mean, that literally is something. I mean, you know, you're talking to people who are susceptible to, I mean, you have a powerful spiritual figure like the Pope, and he's coming into a place where 1 in 4 people are HIV positive, and he's explicitly telling them not to use condoms, right? So there's a manifestation. I mean, aside from the abortion thing, there's a manifestation of this kind of thinking that is criminal, that kills people, that literally kills people. So Susanna, one of the things you said that it's basically never okay. But when it's the life of the mother, right? If you're in a situation where the mother's going to die, the baby's going to die too, or the fetus is going to die too, then in those cases, you're saying it's permissible because at least you get to save one life instead of losing both of them?
Or so is that not clear it's either? It's a little bit messy. So it has to... Actually, let me find an exact quote if you can continue on another thought in the meanwhile, and I can give you more precise information as I look through my notes.
Right, sure. So, so another thing is that, you know, I wanted to bring Christopher Hitchens' quote here too, is that, you know, this is directly related to like this idea of not having, allowing abortion. This is directly related to the autonomy of women, I mean, that's why we use the term pro-choice for this. So a lot of this comes down to women making their own choices about their own reproductive choices, about what they want to do with their bodies or how often they want to have children and how they want to plan, you know, their families. So this is I think it was like 2011 or 2010, probably 2010, when Christopher Hitchens, I think one of the last major debates he did was here in Toronto, where I am. It was the Monk debate series, and he was debating Tony Blair, right? And they were talking about, you know, religion, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. And they brought up the point of poverty. And Tony Blair was obviously, you know, on the pro-religion side. And this is, I think, Toronto's current, I mean, Canada's current prime minister, Justin Trudeau, was also in the audience at the time. There were a lot of people. It was a very well-attended debate. And there is a video clip on it where Christopher Hitchens talked about the cure for poverty. He's like, there is a cure for poverty, and that is the empowerment of women. Right? Where women are basically put through this sort of animal cycle of just having children, child after child after child. And this is, you know, around the world. They're not given any choice in the way they want to live their lives and the way they want to use it. They're not even given any autonomy over their bodies. And that the poverty is a direct result of that. And so, and you talk about the association. It's the kind of thing that when you empower women, you just get rid of poverty. It happens. It works all over the world. I think you gave the examples of Bangladesh, of Bolivia, you know, places where women are empowered to make reproductive choices. There isn't poverty where they're not allowed to do that. There is. So it's connected to, it's not just when you're talking about the autonomy of women, you're also talking about education. You're also talking about half of the workforce. That's directly related to your GDP. It's related to your economy. I mean, this is not just a matter of reproductive choice. This is something that has impact globally. It has, you know, like the HIV thing, disease. There's so many implications of this. And, you know, they just bleed out in all kinds of issues. So it's not just a reproductive choice issue, but that is the crux of it.
Anyway, yeah, so I looked it up to be specific. So basically, abortion across the board is looked at as intrinsically evil. Like, that's the terminology that's used for it. But, quote, however, it does recognize as morally legitimate certain acts which indirectly result in the death of a fetus, as when the direct purpose is removal of a cancerous womb, for example. In accordance with the principle of double effect, in the rare cases of indirect abortion, such as when in an ectopic pregnancy the fallopian tube is removed, or in cases of ovarian cancer. In these cases, the procedure is aimed only at preserving the woman's life, and the death of the fetus, although foreseen, is not willed either as an ends or as means for obtaining the intended effect. So even then, that's very specific in terms of saving the life of the mother. It's not across the board.
So they've actually outlined specifically the instances where they think that the life of the mother is at risk. And this includes usually really, really dire circumstances like an ectopic pregnancy. An ectopic pregnancy is when you have a pregnancy that's not in the uterus. You know, it can be sometimes in the fallopian tube, in the ovary, occasionally in the rectal area. So it can be anywhere. So that's never going to really get to term anyway. It's super painful. So in those conditions, if there's ovarian cancer, if there's a cervical or a uterine cancer, where you have to remove it anyway, right? And that would, but you don't will the death of the fetus. You just looking to save the life of the mother in that case.
Yes, but then when you think about those procedures where it is to save the life of the mother, but you will be willing the fetus, that's not okay.
That's not okay. Got it. Okay, so yeah, that is really strict. It's really, really specific. And so what is it? It's kind of interesting that Catholics in the U.S., I mean, the majority of them tend to be Democrat. They tend to be pro-choice. So this is something I'm going to actually talk about a little bit with Islam and, you know, the way that the way it's actually practiced versus what the doctrine is. But what is the reason for that? I mean, the Pope, it seems like the Catholic authority, the central Catholic authority, is still very much against abortion.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's unequivocal. It's very interesting. I was actually looking up some statistics on this. So Catholics are actually very likely to use contraception. Yeah. Let me find the exact statistic. 99% of Catholics have at one point used a contraception method other than natural family planning. So of course the Catholic Church only promotes natural family planning. Mm-hmm. So 99% of Catholic women have said that they have used a different form of contraception than that at some point in their life.
By natural family planning,
like the rhythm method.
Oh, the rhythm method. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. As in, but not like pulling out and stuff. That's not considered.
No. Hell no. You're not allowed to do that. Are you kidding me? God killed a guy for that. He killed a man
for that. Or just abstinence. Abstinence. Apparently it works aside from Mary, the Virgin Mary.
Yes, of course, right?
99.99% of the time.
It was really interesting. So this is some statistics actually from 2020. If we break it down even further by current contraceptive type among women who are at risk of unintended pregnancy, we find that people across religious affiliations use the full spectrum of methods. For example, among Catholic women, 25% use sterilization, 15% use long-acting reversible contraceptions like IUDs, 25% use hormonal methods like birth control pills. And same goes for abortion. In fact, research has consistently shown that the majority of people who obtain an abortion have a religious affiliation. According to the most recent Guttmacher Institute data in 2014, 24% of abortion patients identified as Catholic. That's in line with the average, which is around 22%. Something like that. So for Catholic women who get abortions, I've seen statistics from 22% of people who procure abortions are Catholic all the way to 27%. And I even saw articles written about how a not insubstantial amount of them are married Catholic women as well. So I think you're asking why. There's probably a much larger... there's a lot going on culturally with American Catholics. Like a lot of people are just culturally Catholic. You know, they're not necessarily like a very convicted, Catholic. It's just something that is part of their familial culture or maybe an ethnic identity, in fact. And so they might not be as likely to be as firm within the tenets and following the laws of the Catholic Church. I think a lot of it is, I actually was reading an article in preparation for this by a pro-choice Catholic who leads an organization, who fights for pro-choice, acknowledging that within the Catholic Church or within the Catholic community. And he was emphasizing the importance of conscience in Catholics' decisions and how within, Catholic theology and thought, the emphasis on one's own conscience is actually supposed to come before the Catholic law and doctrine, as long as one understands what those laws and doctrines are. So that they made this argument for this rule of conscience, and also the I can't remember the word off the top of my head. But speaking on the fact that there is Catholic thought and doctrine that says that there are laws, Catholic laws can only be valid, that might not be the right word, to the extent in which they are actually believed and followed by the flock, so to speak. And this is something that is resoundingly rejected by the flock in many countries. So therefore, it does not have as much credulity or credibility. Which are interesting arguments, but I found them unconvincing. And maybe this is like a fundamentalist in me or something, but I'm like, by what authority are you saying this? You know?
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. When you want to modernize something, you can do it. But it is really interesting to me because, you know, that's a Catholic authority. And you know, who were the two U.S. presidents who were Catholic? John F. Kennedy and now Joe Biden, and they're both Catholic. Super, super pro-choice.
Joe Biden actually isn't personally pro-choice. He says personally that it's something he disagrees with, he doesn't like. But he is basically more admirably than many other leaders saying that's not my place to impose that in the public sphere. That would be a rejection of our separation of church and state. So he's taking a secular stance to it, basically.
But he's also, I mean, what he's doing the whole strategic ambiguity thing. Cause I mean, if you don't like it personally, because you think it's murder, then, you know, it's really unlikely that you're going to say, well, I think it's okay if other people can, you know, murder if they want. Like, it's just not something I like. It's a strange kind of thing, but it's a good sort of political way to play both sides of it. But either way, like the majority of Catholics in the U.S., Mexico, you know, around 80% of the people in Mexico identify as Catholics. They call themselves, and they're religious too. And Mexico just legalized abortion as well.
You know, so. No, they didn't legalize it. They decriminalized it.
They decriminalized it. Well, okay. Yeah, that's a, got it. So there's, I don't know. It's just interesting. Now, what about the non-Catholics? What about the, I mean, you see the evangelicals, people like, is Rick Santorum Catholic? I think he is, right? Or no?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know.
Because,
well, in terms of, I believe the people who are, I saw some Pew research recently that shows the most pro-life, the most firmly pro-life people in the country are white evangelicals.
Which, yeah, that's the thing.
I was thinking about it today. I actually don't like the characterization of Protestants as evangelicals because Christianity, Islam are both evangelical faiths. Catholicism is evangelical. So really they mean Protestant, but even that's more specific to usually meaning a Pentecostal or Baptist bent is when people say evangelical. So I think that's really what they're trying to get at.
Yeah. I think the term has now settled as a Protestant thing. It's kind of like Semitic peoples, right? Semitic peoples include Arabs and Jews, but you know, now we just think of it as Jews. So Rick Santorum said, yeah, he is a Catholic, and he has only actually, like you said, he's only had sex when he wanted to have kids. And I think he's got like 7 kids or something. He's got a lot of kids. And that's the only time he's ever done it, apparently. And so, yeah. And Lois is actually saying in the comments, she's saying, yes, Rick Santorum is a Catholic. So, yeah. So what is it with the Protestants? What is the variety there? Are there any sort of sects in Christianity that are more permissible, more permissive when it comes to abortion, or is it just really strict across the board?
Okay, so honestly, I was not familiar with it until I was studying the Islamics thing. And again, so my understanding of this is going to come from Yakin Institute. It's from an Islamic source, but I really liked how they summarized it. So give me a second. American Baptist churches condemn abortion yet don't take a hard stance against it, opting to encourage their membership to seek spiritual counsel as they prayerfully and conscientiously consider their decision. Presbyterians generally disapprove of abortions yet affirm them to be personal decisions that should be left to the parents and not restricted by law. The United Methodist Church affirms that it is, quote, equally bound to respect the sacredness of life and the well-being of the mother and the unborn child. The Lutherans and evangelicals generally view abortion as immoral at any point unless it is to prevent the death of the mother, and in some cases of rape and incest. It is also the general position of the Church of England, which combines, quote, strong opposition to abortion with the recognition that there can be strictly limited conditions under which it may be morally preferable to any available alternative. So out of all of those, the Catholic Church is by far the most restrictive.
Sorry, I was muted. Okay, so it is the most restrictive. The other thing I wanted to know was, and, you know, so this is something I've always found interesting because in Islam, scripture really matters a lot. So the hadith and the Quran and, you know, so what they say has a huge impact on the way that people think about this. But with Christianity, whether it's Catholicism or anything else, I mean, you have the Bible doesn't say anything about abortion, right? Or does it?
I don't think that's true. There's obviously thou shalt not kill. So that's often cited when talking about
Expelling a fetus. Like, it doesn't say anything. I mean, there's one place in the Bible where it talks about if you hurt a woman with a child, right? And that causes the child to be expelled from her, or the fetus to be expelled from her, then that person will be punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. So this is something, this is from Exodus, it's in the Old Testament, but this is really about harming the woman. If you're harming the woman, you cause her to lose her fetus. That's what's punished. But aside from that, there's nothing about abortion, it seems, in the Bible. In fact, okay, and it seems, you know, from what I'm seeing, is that in the Bible, life, when they talk about life, they talk about a baby drawing his first breath or her first breath. Okay, so it's about when you draw your first breath. So in Genesis, in Genesis 2:7, it says, you know, then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. So, you know, the definition of life in the Bible is when the thing starts breathing, when it starts breathing, and fetuses don't breathe, right? They don't. Unless they're talking about, the diffusion of oxygen across like chorionic villi in the placenta or something. But I really, really doubt that that's the case. When they're talking about breath, they're talking about breathing into something, air, right? So this is, this is something that I find really fascinating, that the Bible pretty much in several places defines life as associates it with humans that are breathing, which effectively means life begins at birth, not at conception. Then it doesn't actually address abortion or even allude to it anywhere. Adi Boudreau in the comments one of our patrons is saying that abortion is mentioned in the Apocalypse of Peter, but that wasn't canonized. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I didn't know about that.
So for reference, I went to go to the Catechism really quickly. Mm-hmm. And the Catechism does reference specific passages from the Bible, although they are not specifically pertaining to abortion. This is what some of the verses used to justify it. Right. So for example, Jeremiah 1:5 is, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you. There are sections from Job that are used, like Job 8-12.
This is saying even before the womb, right?
Yes. I mean,
that's talking about even before the womb. So,
yeah. And that's a bit longer, so I'm not going to read that whole thing. And then there's also Psalm chapter 22, 10-11. From birth, I was cast on you. From my mom's womb, you have been my God. Do not be far from me, for trouble is near and there is no one to help. So those are more talking about how it is contrary to God's will, and that itself is a gravely evil and immoral thing to do. So it's less about it's condemning abortion by way of its interference with God's will.
Yeah, I understand. But I think that none of these, like the concept of removing a fetus from the mother's womb and that being equated with murder, that's something that, like that's the actual concept of abortion, you know what we mean? I mean, this is, again, the people who are writing this, or the people writing this, or the, you know, whatever being wrote this, whatever you believe. I mean, this is not the kind of thing that, they could have said it pretty clearly. You know, you're not allowed to take a fetus out of the womb.
You're asking religious scripture to be clear, and
because it's clear when it comes to everything else. Like, we have the Ten Commandments, like, you shouldn't covet your neighbor's wife or something. Well, that's not a real thing, but you know what I mean. You shouldn't.
But
kill.
It is clear, Ali. The fifth commandment is thou shalt not kill, and you are killing a human life because life starts at conception, according to the Catholic Church.
But it's not a human life because it's not a human life until it starts breathing, according to the Bible. According to the Bible, it's not a human life until it starts breathing.
Well, and now you're asking.
That's actually a lot of the Catholic Church. I understand. I don't expect the Catholic Church to understand the book, like their own book that they follow. But I mean, the book says one thing; they say another. I mean, it seems pretty clear. Like for instance, you know, you have all of these all this legislation in Islamic societies, Muslim societies about rape. Rape isn't even a concept in the Quran. It isn't even mentioned.
True.
Like the term doesn't exist because the way that they have the illegitimate sex and legitimate sex is basically about whether you're doing it within the confines of marriage or outside marriage. So it's like illegitimate is fornication, adultery. Legitimate is, you know, when you're married to somebody. Now, if you're married to somebody,
you don't have to be married to have sex
or
with
slaves.
Who you're, yeah. Come so on,
married,
Ollie.
Yeah, married or slave girls. And when you're married and you have a slave, right, with them, even if you force it on them, there's no consent. That's still legitimate according to Islam. If it's outside of marriage or slave girl, like it's crazy that we have to actually mention that to be inclusive of the whole thing. But if
we're
it's
very inclusive here,
I'm trying to be very meticulous, not getting anything wrong. So when it's outside of these confines, even if it's consensual, right, it's illegitimate. And the thing is, it's always that the reason it's like that is because from the point of view of a man. You know, the point of view of a man, it's like, you know, the woman is the property. It's supposed to be his. So consensual or not, as long as she's his wife or a slave girl, it's okay.
If she refuses, doesn't she get cursed by angels all by night angels. Too? Yeah.
Yeah. He calls that's her. Even if she's at the stove, she has to go and serve him. That's in the hadith, though. That's not in the Quran. But either way, those are the distinction. I mean, rape doesn't exist. And people, whenever they talk about rape in Islam, there's a verse in the Psalm that says, you know, you can't marry your daughters against their will, right? Which has nothing to do with, I mean, that's not explicitly about rape. And that's kind of what it seems like these passages in the Bible are doing. I think they're looking for things that are super general, right? And then they're like in that verse 47:4, when it talks about corruption, those who spread corruption across the land, they say that they're talking about rape. But if Allah really wanted to say, don't rape, he would have said it. He said everything else. Don't eat pork. He said, don't eat pork. So why wouldn't he say, don't rape? I mean, if the God of the Bible said, thou shalt not kill, I should not take the Lord name of the Lord in vain. You can't take the, like, that is so clear. Don't take the name of the Lord in vain. But the rape thing, well, you know, there's all these other sort of indirect passages I have that you can use to you know, to talk about abortion or rape. It just doesn't compute. So I think that it's really interesting. That there is that discrepancy between how clear the stuff is in the Bible and how clearly and animatedly the adherents, like the Catholics and the evangelicals and everything, really stick to this whole idea of abortion.
Yeah, well, I think we should get into what actually is the Islamic stance, because right. When I was going through my outrage over that cartoon that we started with at the beginning, I found a really interesting article on religiondispatches.com, which is titled "Please Stop Using Islam to Critique the Abortion Ban. It Simply Excuses the Very Christian, Very White Roots of the Anti-Choice Movement" by Dr. Sajidja Jalalzai. And here are some quotes that I thought were very interesting.
I know Sajidja Jalalzai. Oh. I didn't know she wrote that article. And she's really cool. I totally disagree with her on this, and I disagree with her on a lot of things, but I don't think she's going to be listening to this, but Sajda, anybody knows her. Like, she's an awesome person. Very, very talented musician as well. Like, incredible. But anyway, cool. And she's like a progressive, she's very a progressive Islamic, I think. But I don't remember exactly what degree she did, but she's got a PhD in it.
Well, she's an associate professor of Islamic studies at a Texan university, I believe.
That's right. Yeah.
Anyways, so she had a critique of these kind of images and these comparisons coming out. And there are two quotes that I thought were very interesting. quote, these tags and images show how Islam and Muslims continue to be used in America as shorthand for misogyny, barbarism, and oppression. Not only do they rehash age-old Islamophobic stereotypes about the inherent and equally repressive nature of Islam, particularly in relation to the treatment of women, but they also overlook the roots of the modern anti-abortion movements in America and its connection with white Christian nationalism. And then in this article, she goes on to talk about what actually is the Islamic stance on these things. And I didn't know these things. I didn't. It was very interesting to me. I thought, you know, me being Catholic, I'm like, you're telling me everyone isn't this restrictive? But basically, there's debate or contention within the different schools about when it's okay. And the central issue is this issue of ensoulment. And when does a soul become breathed into the fetus or embryo? And this is very interesting to me because from a Catholic standpoint, as soon as, you know, at the moment of conception, that is the ensoulment, so to speak. That used to be different historically, but that's kind of the decision nowadays. So do you want to get more into the specifics?
Yeah, I will. So what happens is generally in most Islamic scholars and, you know, the most Muslims in the world subscribe. I'm not saying that they actually know that they do, but they subscribe to schools of thought that allow abortion within the first 4 months. So ensoulment, you're talking about, that's E-N-S-O-U-L-M-E-N-T. Ensoulment is when the soul enters the fetus, all right, or this being, and that happens according to most of them at 120 days. Some say it happens at 40 days. You know, Hamza Yusuf. No, I don't know if it's Hamza Yusuf or Yasser Qadhi. I keep on getting both of them mixed up. I think it's Yasser Qadhi. he's a contemporary scholar, and he also says 40 days. So there are four. If you look at the Sunnis, which is the majority, you know, of the Muslim population of the world. There are four major sects, schools of thought among Sunnis, and there's the Hanafi sect, there's the Hanbali sect, there's the Shafi and the Malikis. So the Hanafis, which is, you know, the most common, is they allow abortion before 4 months. So before 120 days, you're allowed to, you know, it's not a sin to abort.
Apparently, the Hanafi school, this is another quote from Yakin Institute. By the way, I know the Yakin Institute is criticized by fundamentalists as being like fake Muslims who are like trying to like lead the Ummah astray because they're kind of more like interfaith, like relatively more LGBT friendly and all this stuff. So I did go to look up what Daniel Hakikachu had to say about it.
Yeah.
Did not find anything particularly helpful, but I did do my due diligence. So don't come at me for quoting Yakin, okay?
You always have to look at what Hakika Jude's saying about anything.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
The dominant Hanafi position is far more lenient in permitting abortion up to 120 days from conception, with some even allowing it without the husband's permission. Now, this is very interesting to me because the Taliban is actually follows the more Deobandi strain of the Hanafi school of jurisprudence.
Yeah.
So these like memes and cartoons and then like, this is so inaccurate.
Yeah. It is very inaccurate. So this is me editorializing, but I'm pretty confident that this has something to do with it. If you look at the history of Christianity or, you know, there's a lot of celibacy there. And the Pope is celibate, all the priests are celibate. Jesus himself, you know, so you're only not allowed to have sex for pleasure. So it's kind of understandable, like, well, abortion is, you know, the fetus is very sacred, the embryo is very sacred. Islam is not really like that, is it? Like, it's the exact opposite. It's anti-celibacy. It's like, oh,
it was so funny. I was talking to Armin wife. About this.
Yeah.
He was like, well, the Sahaba, they were really horny. They wanted to F all the time. Well, like, of course they have stuff on abortion. That's and they're actually way more permissive on contraception as well. I was very surprised by this.
Yeah, because they had to. I mean, they wanted to. That's what they wanted to do. They were going out. There were prisoners of war that you were legally allowed to have sex with. Surah 4, verse 24, everybody out there who thinks that I'm just making this up. Surah 4, verse 24 says, starts off by saying, and those women who your right hands possess, captives of war. It says, all married women are forbidden to you except captives of war. Which means that you can have sex with captives of war even if they're married. Like, even if they have husbands, you are allowed, that you're legally allowed to have sex with them. So they really, I mean, temporary wives, permanent wives, slaves, captives of war, it's pretty much the whole thing. So, you know, you can understand, you know, sure, they may, you know, they wanted to do this stuff. So, you know, they wanted to make sure they had their, you know, they
didn't
want to
have kids. And apparently the preferred method of contraception was just the pullout method. Like, there was even a term for it, which I can't remember off the top of my head, but I was, yeah.
Uzzle. Yeah, yeah. This stuff I know.
Oh my goodness.
Pull out. Oh. Yeah, the term for pull out I know in every single language. No. No, I'm kidding. I don't. Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised. No, but as I was doing research for this, I thought it was really interesting. So this ensoulment happens like with certainty at 120 days after the conception. But there are exceptions where abortion is permissible depending on the stage of the pregnancy and the reason. So there are some, so until 40 days, and this is all based on Sunni understandings, okay, is permitted with the reasons of rape or physical or mental inability to raise a child. Which, yes, I thought was interesting. If you don't think you're mentally capable, even that's a good enough reason. And then, so there's like the first 40 days, which is actually pretty similar to the Texas heartbeat bill. And there are some that like firmly cut it off there. And then there's some where there's this further period of up to 120. So then up until the 120, then the only permitted reasons are rape or extreme fetal abnormality. And then after,
or the health of the mother, like extreme,
yes, no, no. After 120 days, the only permittable excuse is the health of the mother.
Right, got it. You're right.
And they defined feticide as the killing of an ensouled fetus, or the killing of a soul-bearing child, which I thought was very interesting. So at that point, it becomes murder.
Right, and so like going specifically into schools of thought, the Hanafis and the Hanbalis and the Shafis, right? They all allow abortion to varying levels. And the Hanafis are totally cool with it, up to 120 days. Like, do whatever you want, abort, abort, abort. They're all good. The
oh my God.
I mean, okay, I'm being a little glib about it, but yeah, the Shafis and the Hanbalis, they're like, okay, they have some restrictions, but you know, there's a term called makruh in Islam. So makruh means that it's not halal, it's not haram, it's somewhere in the middle. It's like, you know, sin purgatory. And, you know, liberal Muslims don't really care. Every time when we were growing up and someone told us, they're like, no, this isn't haram, it's just makruh. We're like, yeah, whatever. Okay, it was a makruh, who cares? Like, as long as I'm not going to hell. Like, they used to tell us that about masturbation. I was like, masturbation is makruh, it's not haram, right? It's not haram, it's like, go, just, you know, jerk, jerk, jerk. So, abort, abort, abort. So, there's a... yeah, so there is a that category. So some of these schools of thought, you know, they'll talk about abortion being makruh. So there's some restriction on it, but it's not outright banned. After 120 days, though, none of the schools of thought allow it. But the majority of them, the majority of Muslims in the world, do live in places where at least the doctrine that's subscribed to allows abortion in the first 4 months, 120 days. Now, this is very different from the way it's actually practiced in Muslim-majority countries.
Mm-hmm.
So in Muslim-majority countries, abortion is overall much, much more restricted than the permissibility of the doctrine that we're talking about. This is kind of similar to what we were saying about Christianity, how the, you know, abortion isn't really a big deal in the Bible. I mean, it's not explicitly mentioned or defined or anything like that. But the way that it is in practice, the way it's interpreted is a completely different issue. So in Islam as well, there are only two countries in the world, two Muslim majority countries in the world, that allow abortion on demand. And that's Turkey and Tunisia. Anything that starts with TU. So Turkey and Tunisia are the only ones. And there are many other countries that allow abortion with certain restrictions. Many of them, it's outright banned, like completely illegal in sort of very, very few, in a minority of Muslim majority countries. And in most cases, in most of them, it is definitely like the laws around it are a lot more liberal than say evangelicals or Catholics would like them to be in their kind of situations. So that's that's another discrepancy, like between the doctrine and the way this actually applied.
What's really interesting is that Saudi law is technically more forgiving than SB8 because they have exceptions for incest and rape. SB8 doesn't.
And Taliban law is too. I mean, that's one place where the cartoon was accurate. I mean, when it comes to this one specific issue, it's accurate. And there are other implications to it too. It's not just the abortion. I mean, stem cell research, for instance, not a taboo in Islam. It's just not that big of a deal when it comes to, but in Christianity or even the US, like with George W. Bush, you know, when it's a huge deal.
Oh my gosh. It has implications today in 2021, but I can't talk about it because YouTube is too finicky. So I found some information on this. I'll just read this. I quote, similarly, abortion laws in other Muslim majority countries allow pregnancies to be terminated in cases of rape, incest, fetal impairment, or risk to a mother's mental or physical health. These exceptions to abort bans exist in Kuwait, Jordan, Qatar, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. In Turkey, abortion is legal and free during the first trimester. Thereafter, it is allowed only if a woman's life is at risk or to protect her physical and mental health, or in the case of fetal abnormality. Similar exceptions are legalized in the North African countries, Tunisia, Morocco, and Algeria. And Tunisia, like Turkey, provides free abortions in the first trimester of pregnancy at public health facilities with no restrictions. I thought this was very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really interesting.
Do you have any other thoughts on this issue, or should we take some patron questions?
I think we can. We have a good patron question right now that just came up.
Yes. So reminder to everyone, if you are listening to this audio, that if you are listening and you enjoy this, you know, please consider becoming a patron, or there's also donating on PayPal. If you are a patron, you get access to all of the videos of these shows, and you can sign up for as little as $1 a month. And not only do you get the videos, but also you can interact with us in the live chat, or you can ask your questions ahead of time in case you're not able to attend the episodes live because of your time zone or your schedule. So please consider supporting the show. The first question we have is from Music Guy, saying, if a Muslim woman wants an abortion, does she have to get permission from her husband first? There is differences in this, actually. Mm-hmm. There are some cases where it's actually potentially permitted if she doesn't. But from what I was reading, in most cases, it's supposed to be a decision that's made as a couple.
Yeah. I don't actually think, Music Guy, there is any clear direction on this in the doctrine. I don't think it's explicitly said. A lot of times it's understood that she has to get permission from their husband. But in this case, I don't think that there is. And, you know, if I'm wrong, please, you know, send me whatever information you have. But on a practical level, the way that this is done in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, some of these like really large Muslim majority countries, the women do have to get permission from their husband. They have to get them to sign. And even for general medical care, all kinds of different procedures have to. I mean, one of the first things, I went to medical school in Pakistan. One of the first cases I had, surgical cases that I assisted with, was a woman who had cervical cancer. She was diagnosed with cervical cancer, and she had four daughters. And they had recommended which, you know, it's like you got to get a hysterectomy, you know, and get your cervix and your uterus removed. And her husband and her mother-in-law, the husband's mother, didn't allow it because she hadn't had a son yet. Like, you know, would let her
have a son first.
So by the time we got to it, you know, the cancer had spread like throughout her uterus, and it was a pretty horrendous case. So that was the first sort of surgical case I ever assisted with. And it was pretty jarring. So so husbands do have to give permission for certain procedures to happen, unfortunately. And you know, that it's like that, I think, in a lot of Muslim majority countries, but in the doctrine, I'm not sure if that is an absolute requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So the next question from Deep Boudreau, but is
it's kind of the similar thing. Like Muslim guy was talking more about the actual doctrine, and then D is talking about what the reality is in the countries. And I feel like you kind of answered that. It was interesting. Yeah. Well, studying for this today, I was reading an article that I sent to Ali about how Pakistan has one of the highest abortion rates in the world, actually.
That's a great article.
Really surprised me. And in this article, Ali, I can hear myself a little bit. I think the volume's loud.
But, I'm myself.
In the article, it talks about how there's not a lot of seeming like clarity over how much these procedures are actually allowed, either Islamically or through the law. And so because of this lack of clarity, or maybe just certain providers' unwillingness to do these procedures, a lot of women have to do it themselves or do back alley procedures. Like there was one woman that, the article starts out profiling this woman who's 19 years old. She's had 5 pregnancies. She got pregnant again, and she's trying to make herself lose the pregnancy because her husband told her, if you have a daughter, like, I'm going to harm you, basically. And it talks about these really severe instances that women are in, usually of a very low socioeconomic class, that they have to find all these like under the radar ways to go about these procedures, even though there is, you know, some doctrinal justification that this is okay. And there's not a clear understanding of the letter of the law or the Islamic law. So it leaves women in this really dangerous middle ground. But I was really surprised by that statistic. I wouldn't have guessed that that was the case in Pakistan.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and these are all sort of back alley abortions. There are certain things that they tell you. I think one of them was boiled date juice, or
sort of boiled, that's kind of like a home remedy or something.
Date stew and everything, and then apparently that induces abortions. So that's and you know, aside from the abortion thing, there are a lot of, like, especially in villages and things like that, a lot of these girls, like 13, 14, 15, I mean, I remember seeing them again when I was in our sort of community health sciences stuff that we used to do through medical school. And they get pregnant, and there's rape. Sometimes there's incest with their uncles. I mean, almost the incest is a really, really big issue in Pakistan. And these young girls, they get pregnant. And if they get pregnant, then they, you know, to avoid the that's associated with shame, even though it's not their fault, their kids. And they're taken to these places. They give birth to the kid because they can't have an abortion. Often their mother, their older sister or something will take them. They'll give birth to these kids, and then they just leave, and the kids are left there. And often these kids are adopted, right, by other people. And sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're just kept in orphanages. So it's a pretty bad situation. This is the problem. Like, you know, when you, it's not just the consequences of we're used to that whole hanger thing. You know, you've got the coat hanger and you use that to induce an abortion for yourself, the back alley stuff. But, there are also a lot of kids being born, right? These women who cannot get abortion, or young girls actually who can't get abortions, and, they're being abandoned. And they're being raised in really, really terrible orphanages. They're growing up with more abuse. And, you know, the cycle just repeats itself. It perpetuates itself. It worsens with time. So, you know, these restrictions on abortion and the choice of women to actually make their own reproductive choices, again, has, I mean, I can't stress this enough. The implications of this are, they go far and wide, much, much more beyond just babies and birth.
Mm-hmm. So Music Guy is saying, so if it's a rape situation, she can go in by herself and not need approval if she's not married yet, or would she need her parents to approve? Do you mean this from a baseline, what is the lived reality experience? Or do you mean from a doctrinal standpoint? Because I didn't see anything in terms of this doctrine regarding this. In terms of the lived reality, it probably depends on the country. Like, it sounds like in Tunisia and Turkey, it'd be much easier.
It also depends on, you know, how they define rape. I mean, you know, if you have like in the case, the article that you sent me, Susanna, this girl, Mehnaz, in the article was the first time she got pregnant was she was 13. Or she was married at 13 to her cousin, her first cousin. And when she was 19, she had her fifth kid. So if you define rape as, you know, having sex with a child, then yes, you know, then in that case, she can't go in by herself because, again, to have these procedures done, she did need permission from her husband. Or either she had to be 40 years old or have permission from her husband. I mean, you know, how many people can be having their babies after age 40? So it does depend on the place, but the rape situation doesn't really, marital rape is not considered rape in a lot of these societies. So I don't think that there's any sort of clear demarcation about whether it matters, you know, if it's rape or not.
Mm-hmm. And then D is asking, is there any Muslim religious procedure done with the remains? Some places in the United States require burial. Are you familiar with anything like this?
No, I'm not. I don't think that there's a, like I don't think it's required. I think generally that it would be anything for anybody else who dies is they do burial, right? But there are other ways you can also dispose of remains in Islam, like what they did with Osama bin Laden. The water burial is actually an allowed Islamic method of burial too. It's rarer and it's only allowed in circumstances, and but they do that as well. So yeah, I don't think there's any sort of prescription on how the remains should be disposed of.
Yeah. And then Muslim guy, Music Guy is asking, I wonder if there is a limit to how many abortions they can have. Right. Well, I will say that it's not from a doctrinal standpoint. My understanding is this isn't encouraged. I think a reasonable healthcare provider would say, hey, try other forms of contraception first before consistently falling on this one. So I think it's a very similar situation where it's certainly not encouraged. And again, if you mean by what is the actual experience living in these countries, I can't tell you specifically.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there is any sort of specification on that either, whether there's any, how many abortions they can have. It's just that if you're pregnant before 120 days, in most cases, you're allowed to abort.
What's interesting, though, is that poverty is not a valid excuse, or fear of poverty is not a valid excuse that makes the abortion permissible. That's what I learned. Because the idea is that Allah will provide.
Yeah,
so that's, you shouldn't worry about poverty.
That also depends. I mean, in some cases, like, you know, you mentioned if the woman or the girl is not, I always have to say girl because a lot of these girls are underage, unfortunately. But you know when you said that they said whether it's physically or mentally incapable of raising a child, those parameters are not defined. Like, what does it mean mentally incapable? And again, this is less about the doctrine, more about how it's applied in these countries. So you can really make the argument for, you can bring the poverty example as something that would physically or mentally limit a girl from raising a child or being a mother. So it really depends.
Mm.
So let's take
Last question from D is, does abortion provoke honor culture or shunning?
Oh, good question. So abortion will, if you are found out to be pregnant, if you're found to be pregnant, it very well could, whether you abort or whether you don't abort. But typically, if you are pregnant and supposing, you know, you have, and this often happens, you know, you have a young girl who gets pregnant because, you know, she's raped by her uncle or something. And then the mother finds out she's pregnant. She's going to give her a little crap for it, but then she'll sort of very secretly take her to a place where she can have the abortion or she can deliver the baby, right? And then she can just come back. And if she doesn't get found out, then it doesn't matter. But yeah, if you're found out and people find out that you did get pregnant outside of marriage, then it very well could provoke honor culture or shunning, even from the family of the girl who may even know that she was raped and it wasn't her fault.
I feel like it will be found out eventually, though. Like, say this happens before marriage, you go on to be married. Like, you can tell when someone's body is different because they delivered a pregnancy.
Well, a lot of these guys, I mean, they don't have a whole lot of experience.
Oh, they don't have context?
Marriage. Yeah, so they don't really have a comparison. They just think, oh, this is probably what it's like everywhere.
Even like all the skin on the belly, how it gets totally stretched and the stretch marks, and they wouldn't be like, huh, why is this so much looser here than everywhere else?
They don't think so. There's no concept. I mean, they don't even know. A lot of these men are actually virgins before they get married. I mean, there's no, most of them are. I mean, they're virgins before they actually get married. The first time they actually have sex is afterwards. A lot of times is the first time they actually see a woman naked outside of, well, I guess now they have like internet porn, but outside of that, often they never see like the girls around them in that way either. So I don't think they have a frame of reference. And you know, you can, so I think you could probably hide it. And most of them do. The test that they really go for is the whole bleeding test, which is totally unreliable, as you know.
I can't believe that's still a thing.
The virginity thing. So often there are ways to fake it.
Yeah.
The fake the bleeding thing. So these are sort of tricks that are passed down from people to people, from, you know, person to person, like mother to daughter or something like that. But yeah, it's a really depressing situation out there in those places. So yeah, and compared to that, the women in Texas definitely have it good. It does not mean you rest on your laurels and do nothing about what's happening in Texas.
Of course not.
Yeah, it's not about, you know, whether they have it good or not. It's the thing is, in a place like that, this is the way you think of it. In a place like the United States, which is supposed to be this beacon of liberty and freedom and enlightenment, and in a place like that, if you have the judicial system failing women, failing the people in, you know, one of its largest and most prominent states, one of its richest states, in a state that is one of the capitals for healthcare in the world, right? I mean, some of the best healthcare and doctors and medical institutions are in Texas. If you can't get it right there when it comes to women's reproductive choice, and what hope do women have in other places when they're looking to this place as an example? That is the issue. I think that's a better way to frame it if you do want to connect the two.
Yeah, it can validate the most repressive aspects of other cultures and communities across the world. Because they say, well, look, it's happening in the US. Mm-hmm. And that confirms what they want to hear, which is so unfortunate.
Yeah.
But yes, I hope this was educational for everyone. I certainly learned a lot.
Me too.
Please, if you make criticisms of SB8, don't be so freaking dumb about it so that I have to come after you. Okay, yeah. Come correct. But yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. If you guys are listening to the audio version of this, please, please, please make sure to like this video because we mentioned the RAPE word a lot. So it is going to be deprioritized into oblivion. And if you cannot afford to support the show, you can just share this episode. Like if you learned something about the Catholic or Islamic stance on abortion, then, you know, you share it with other people. So maybe they stop saying dumb stuff too. But yeah.
Yeah, I don't think people are going to stop saying dumb stuff.
No. For a while, but
the important thing is, like, if they're talking about it, the only take home message I'm going to give you guys is that when you talk about abortion, when you talk about autonomy of women over their bodies and making their own reproductive choices, it's not just about abortion and sex and babies and women. It's about poverty. It's about half of your workforce. It's about your GDP. It's about your economy. It's about so many different things.
It's about crime rates.
Crime rates, delinquency, you know, just children who are abandoned. They're just not raised properly. It's about
antisocial behavior, drug use. It goes on. Absolutely. Suicidality even.
Uh-huh. So it affects everything. And that's really the important thing to remember when we talk about this issue. So it's yes, it is a women's issue, but it is really a human issue and a world issue overall.
100%.
Yeah. So thanks everybody for listening. And again, consider you can become a patron for less than $1 a month. No, not less than, as little as $1 a month. Sorry. As little as $1 a month. It's going to be at least $1. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but yeah, it's you get 5 episodes. You get to watch them on video. You get to interact with us. You get to submit your questions ahead of time and have them read ahead of time and do all the other good stuff. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Cool. Thank you for joining us. Bye, guys.
Be best.
Be best.
The Secular Jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadists.com and give $1 or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the Flying Spaghetti Monster be with you.